This panel will hear, then we will have a break and a panel change, and Justice Puryear will preside over the next panel. The case this morning is Stephen R. Keith Walker versus the State of Texas. If we could have announcements in that case, please.
Morning, Your Honor. Rob Daniel, appearing for Mr. Walker, and we're ready to proceed.
Morning, Mr. Daniel.
Morning, Your Honor. Renee Gonzalez, appearing for the State of Texas. We're ready.
Morning, Mr. Gonzalez. For those of you who may be new to the third court, each side is given 20 minutes to argue. I understand that you've gotten with the clerk and handled your time allocations as far as time to hold back on rebuttal, et cetera. We have a time warning system, which when we're up here will be the clerk holding up a two-minute warning for you. We don't have the high-tech red light, green light that we had back home. But one thing we do have that we have back home is we recently started doing audio recordings of oral argument. And so the microphone there will take an audio recording of your argument. You will then be able to download it later on the court's website. By way of housekeeping, if anybody in the audience has a cell phone or other device that might go off and distract our litigants, now would be a good time to turn it off. And with that, we will hear from the attorneys. Mr. Daniel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. I very much appreciate the opportunity to present oral argument this morning. I know that's discretionary on the part of the court, and I really appreciate it in this case. I look forward to presenting my arguments to you. If you have any questions along the way, please feel free to ask, and I'll stop and try to address those as best I can. I'm going to start by making three statements, and I think that we're all going to be in agreement on the first statement. I think we're probably going to all be in agreement on the second statement. I don't think we're going to agree on the third statement. Here's the first statement. All felonies are theoretically susceptible to a deadly weapon finding. This court has so held, the Court of Criminal Appeals has so held multiple times. Here's the second statement. When a jury finds a defendant guilty of certain offenses, the jury is necessarily making an affirmative finding that a deadly weapon was used or exhibited in the commission of the offense. This would be the holding in Crumpton v. State, which is a Court of Criminal Appeals case. And here's the third statement. When a jury convicts or finds guilty on certain other offenses, the jury is necessarily making a negative finding as to the use or exhibition of a deadly weapon in the commission of the offense. And I think that's true when we have the type of offense that's at issue in this case. And the type of offense is assault causing bodily injury. In this case, it's a felony offense because it's enhanced with a prior conviction. Typically, it's a misdemeanor offense. And it's also an offense involving family violence in this case. But I think what the Court of Criminal Appeals said in the Landrian case is that the only difference between aggravated assault causing bodily injury and assault causing bodily injury is the absence of a deadly weapon. In other words, if you use a deadly weapon, it's immediately aggravated by the use of the deadly weapon itself. If you cause serious bodily injury, you've also committed aggravated assault. You've impliedly used a deadly weapon to cause that serious bodily injury.
I think you've accurately anticipated someone's thoughts on the third prong of your argument. And I guess the question is there not some prosecutorial discretion for them to bring a lesser charge? And is there really, what's the authority for saying that implicit in the jury finding the use of an aggravated, the use of a weapon, is that it can't be that lesser charge?
So I'll answer the second prong of that question first. And I don't think that there's any direct support for the third statement. I think it's the logical inverse of the Court of Criminal Appeals holding in Crumpton. So if there can be holdings where, or there can be cases where a verdict amounts to an affirmative finding, it should hold true as well that if that there are some cases in which a guilty verdict can indicate a negative finding. And that's because what the Court of Criminal Appeals said in Crumpton is, well, this is just logical, right? So if the offense is murder and the verdict is guilty, well, there has to be a deadly weapon used. And again, due to the Landrian case, we know that when the jury says guilty of assault causing bodily injury, it's an offense that can't include the use of a deadly weapon. And with regard to the prosecutorial discretion, I do think that the prosecutor has a discretion when they see a case where the facts look like aggravated assault to say, you know what, we're going to charge this as assault causing bodily injury as opposed to an aggravated assault. My argument is that when the state does that, It asks the jury in the application paragraph of the court's charge to necessarily make that negative finding. And so when the jury, when the prosecutor decides to indict the defendant for that offense, assault causing bodily injury, the prosecutor is eliminating the possibility that the jury can make an affirmative deadly weapon finding in that case.
But the proof may be the same, right? I mean, the proof could be the same. It's just your point is they wouldn't charge, actually have a special issue on deadly weapon, but the proof may be the same because the hands may be used or, you know, pick your deadly weapon.
That's absolutely correct. I think the proof would be the same. The facts presented to the jury could be the same, but the state's basically putting itself in a corner by charging the offense this way.
And how do we get to, even if we assume, just for the sake of argument, that you're right, how do we get to harmful error, especially in this case where it looks like the standard is going to be egregious harm? How do we get there?
That's right. And so I guess there's a sort of an in-between step before we get to harm, and that's that I'm alleging that due to the implied negative finding, it was improper for the trial court to charge the jury on the special issue of the deadly weapon. And so assuming that was error, then your question is, how do we get to harm? Well, in this case, the defense attorney for Mr. Walker used his entire closing argument on the deadly weapon issue. This was an issue that was not really supported by the evidence at trial. It's a very weak allegation. In the prosecutor's closing argument in the trial court, he says, well, you know hands can be a deadly weapon. You've seen TV shows and news reports that tell you that. Doesn't focus on the proof at trial at all. And so I think what happened here is that this instruction did a couple of things. Number one, it distracted Mr. Walker's trial counsel from making a vigorous defense with regard to the charged offense. The second thing I think it did is when the jury goes back to deliberate, the jury can discuss both the charged offense and the deadly weapon special issue simultaneously. And the court's well aware that when folks get back to the jury room, there's a lot of sort of horse trading and maybe even discussion of things that shouldn't be discussed. And I think that the jury having this discussion about whether the defendant used a deadly weapon or whether serious bodily injury was involved, I think that really informs the jury's discussion of whether an offense was committed of assault causing bodily injury. It makes it much more likely that you're going to reach a guilty verdict on that question when you're also discussing whether there was serious bodily injury or a deadly weapon used. And so I think that's how we get to harm in this case. I think that really the instruction on the deadly weapon, I would say, infected the jury deliberations to the point where they could not freely and fairly discuss only the charged offense. We've got this other issue back there that's affecting the discussion as to whether Mr. Walker was guilty or not guilty of the charged offense.
Do you agree that the evidence of the underlying offense, putting aside the deadly weapon, that it was fairly uncontroverted what happened?
I do agree that with that, and I think I stated that in my brief as well, and Mr. Gonzalez did in his. I think we're in agreement that the state presented some, as you said, uncontroverted evidence of Mr. Walker's guilt through the testimony of the complaining witness in this case. There was some testimony from some of Mr. Walker's family members, but they were not present at the time of the alleged offense. So with regard to the negative finding, I'd like to use a hypothetical to kind of illustrate this for the court. And you will have to use your imagination in this hypothetical to the degree that I'm going to ask you to imagine that the legislature has just made assault causing bodily injury a state jail felony. Okay? So let's say we've got a trial. The defendant is charged with aggravated assault causing bodily injury using a deadly weapon. The court's charge includes a special issue on the deadly weapon. The court's charge also includes an instruction on the lesser offense of assault causing bodily injury. And I think the question for this trial court in writing its charge is, should the deadly weapon special issue also apply to the lesser offense? And I would say no, because if you're considering the lesser offense as the jury, to get to the lesser offense, you have to reject the idea that the defendant used or exhibited a deadly weapon in the commission of the offense. The only way that you can consider a deadly weapon issue is if the defendant used that deadly weapon in flight from the offense. But the jury would have to reject the use in the commission of the offense to get to that lesser included issue. If the court doesn't do that, if the court does the reverse, then the jury can basically do two things. In finding the defendant guilty of the lesser offense, it could reject the deadly weapon issue, but on the special finding, it could say yes to the deadly weapon issue. So imagine you're the defendant. You've just been convicted of a state jail felony, but also there's a deadly weapon finding. So you can be punished on the deadly weapon issue, but not on the deadly weapon issue based on the special finding, but we've also got an implied finding in the judgment that you were not using a deadly weapon in the commission of the offense. The state would say, I think, that it's okay for there to be this inconsistency because the state says in its brief that the Court of Criminal Appeals has allowed inconsistent verdicts. And I don't think that's quite right. The case that the state is relying on is Guthrie Nail, and I think that that case stands for the proposition that inconsistent verdicts are okay when they benefit the defendant. What happened in Guthrie Nail was that a trial court found the defendant guilty of an offense that looks like it should include a deadly weapon affirmative finding. The court says, we're just not going to do it. And the Court of Criminal Appeals finds that there's discretion of a trial court or of a jury to say no when there's a special issue there. I think that the reverse is not true, and I think that that's illustrated by the hypothetical that I just gave the court. That gets us to
before you move off from the hypothetical, I guess the key difference we have here is that the jury actually didn't buy off on the weapons instruction.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so, again, our argument is that it was improper to submit this question to the jury. And the reason is because the court's already impliedly giving that question to the jury when it asks him to find the defendant guilty or not guilty of the charged offense. A finding of guilty on the charged offense, because of the way the state is elected to charge it, again, our argument is it amounts to a negative finding on the use of a deadly weapon. And so the court is basically giving two contradictory instructions to the jury, and then furthermore, those contradictory instructions are causing the jury's deliberations to be different than they would have been if the instruction had not been given. So, coming to our case, again, the argument here is that when the state chose to indict this as assault causing bodily injury, it could not also seek an affirmative deadly weapon finding. We think that, again, the court's instruction that the court consider this as a special issue was error. And as Justice Field, I think your question was very good, but I think we get to egregious harm in this case because of the degree to which the jury must have considered this question in deciding whether Mr. Walker was guilty or not guilty of the charged offense of assault causing bodily injury. Well, I think that's the first time ever I've gotten through with everything I needed to say within 15 minutes. So do y'all have any questions for me before I sit down and let Mr. Gonzalez speak?
We'll hear from the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Gonzalez.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. So the appellant in this case has kind of based his whole argument on a assumption that there are certain types of cases, there are certain types of charges where a deadly weapon finding cannot be sought and cannot be obtained. I don't think that's the law that has been pronounced so far by the courts of this state. I guess he's asking this court to make an exception to the law, to find that somehow this particular set of facts doesn't apply into the general rule. He begins his brief by talking about you can't eat your cake and have it too, and that's a good proverb, and it clearly applies in many situations where two things are mutually exclusive. You can't turn on the light and also have darkness in the room. You can't have your cake and eat it too. That's not what the Court of Criminal Appeals has said about these types of charges. The Court of Criminal Appeals has said it's okay to have inconsistent verdicts. The law allows for that. Granted, it may not make much sense, and there's some opinions about the CCA theorizing that perhaps there are situations where juries might want to grant some sort of clemency by not making an affirmative finding of a deadly weapon, even though it was an element of the offense. And so they want to give the juries that type of latitude. In giving the juries that type of latitude, I think it's important that the state also have the same latitude, the same discretion, if you will, to bring the charges that we think were are appropriate, that we think that we would bring the charges that we believe justice requires. And so I think this court, after the briefs were filed, in Ayala, which was a case handed down in December of last year, and I'm happy to provide a letter, a post-submission letter brief with the site on this, but it was 03-16-00045-CR. The court stated this. The court stated, when presented with seemingly inconsistent findings regarding a deadly weapon, the appellate inquiry is limited solely to a determination of whether the evidence is legally sufficient to support the jury's verdict. And so the issue of whether or not the verdict was inconsistent, the issue of whether or not the deadly weapon finding should have been submitted at all in the jury charge, is not something, this, I would argue, that should really be considered on appeal according to this court's opinion in Ayala. The issue is limited solely to, was it supported by the evidence? And as was noted in during appellant's argument, this is not even a situation where the jury found a deadly weapon finding. The jury sent out a note, said that they were hung up on the deadly weapon finding, and the state withdrew that. The trial court allowed the state to withdraw it. And so we don't even know what the jury would have done. Perhaps they would have come back and found a deadly weapon.
And thank you for bringing up the note. That was one of the questions that I had, is does that note in and of itself indicate some confusion on the part of the jury, or some sort of improper compromise or something like that? Is that note necessarily instructive on the harm analysis, assuming we get to harm?
I don't believe it is. It's anybody who's done this type of work for any length of time knows that juries, we never know what they're thinking. They sent out a note saying at that point in time they were hung up. Would they have continued to be hung up had the trial court given them an Allen charge or told them to continue deliberating? We don't know. So any harm that the appellant sets forth is, at this point, is merely theoretical. It's speculative. And the one thing that the law does require when showing harm from jury charge error is that it be actual harm and not theoretical harm. And in this case, I think all that he's put forth a good case for theoretical harm. Well, maybe this caused him. Well, maybe it didn't, but we don't know. And it's improper for the trial court or for this court to kind of go into the jury's deliberation process and try to figure out what they were thinking. All we know is that that issue was taken away from them, and so there was no harm. The appellant actually benefited in this case from the state withdrawing the deadly weapon instruction or charge from the jury. So it was a situation where he benefited. There was sufficient evidence for the trial court to submit this deadly weapon deadly weapon issue to the jury. I think that's clear from the record. The victim testified. It was a violent assault. All the defendant used was his hands. And quite frankly, I'm surprised that she wasn't more seriously injured. But good for her that she was not. But nevertheless, she very well could have been, given the manner and means and use of the defendant's hands. So I think there was sufficient evidence. All that there needs to be is that there needs to be some evidence from some source that indicates that a deadly weapon may have been used, and it was proper at that point for the trial court to submit the issue to the jury. So going back to Mr. Daniels' discussion that he had, his argument concerning that the finding can be implied. Clearly, an affirmative finding can be implied based on the jury charge, and that's typically in a situation where the court submits to the jury an issue that says, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty as charged in the indictment. If the language in the indictment lists a deadly weapon and the jury finds him guilty as charged, then that's all that's necessary for the court to find make a deadly weapon finding. I don't think the converse is true. If you have a situation where you have an offense that has no serious bodily injury or no allegation of a deadly weapon, for example, perhaps a sexual assault or an evading, something where a weapon is typically not used, it's used a sexual assault, you can still have a deadly weapon special issue submitted to the jury if, in fact, a deadly weapon was used during the offense. So,
is there any distinction between submitting that during the guilt innocence phase versus in sentencing?
Well, it's always been my preference as a state's attorney to have it submitted at the guilt innocence stage, because that way it makes the punishment charge, if it's going to the jury for punishment, it makes the punishment charge clearer. You know which parole instruction to give them, but certainly it can be submitted at any point. I don't think it makes a distinction. I think the CCA, going back to my first argument, the CCA has made it clear that if you have inconsistent verdicts, that's okay. We may not like them, we may not agree with them, but it's up to the jury, and the jury clearly can do that. And so in this case, the jury found the defendant guilty of assault, bodily injury. There was no allegation of serious bodily injury. There was no allegation of a deadly weapon. The thing that made it a felony was the fact that it was a domestic violence situation with a prior conviction, and that made it a felony. It was within the state's discretion to then also seek a deadly weapon finding if the evidence showed that a deadly weapon was used. And in this case, we believe that there was some evidence of that. And it was within the jury's discretion to make the decision, yes, there was a deadly weapon, or no. It just, like I said, they got hung up. We don't know what they would have decided, but that was withdrawn. And the appellant in this case has shown no harm, really. The fact that he used the defense's trial counsel used the bulk of his time and argument to argue about the deadly weapon indicates to me a strategy that may have been the only thing really legitimately he could have argued to and still had credibility with the jury. I think the evidence was pretty clear that the assault happened, it took place, and the defendant committed it. There wasn't much else for the defense trial counsel to argue at that point. So I don't think I would just say I would disagree with Mr. Daniels concerning the implied negative finding, and I just to remind the court that this was a deadly weapon. Of course, goes to parole eligibility when he's eligible for parole. It doesn't do anything to lengthen the sentence. The fact that there was a deadly weapon issue that was submitted to the jury, in my mind, doesn't show harm because the same evidence was used. I mean, the assault is what it was. What it was. It was an assault with bare hands. It was quite a violent assault, and I don't think that the fact that a deadly weapon issue was submitted, which the jury couldn't decide on ultimately, would really make a difference one way or another. They found him guilty of the assault, which I think was the right verdict. They couldn't agree on the deadly weapon finding. There's no harm. And I don't think that the appellant has shown any reason for this court to disturb the trial court's judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gonzalez. Just by way of housekeeping, we have the side on Ayala, so I don't think any post-argument briefing will be necessary.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Daniel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now I've thought of all of the things I should have said to fill the first 15 minutes.
Well,
now I'll try and cram them into
minutes.
The last five. To address Mr. Gonzalez's statements, I think it seems to me that his primary argument is that the submission of the special issue to the jury was proper based on the proof. And that is one of the arguments that we make in our brief, is that the submission of the deadly weapon issue was improper based on the lack of proof presented at trial. But let's assume for the sake of argument that Mr. Gonzalez is right, and there was enough in the record to present this issue to the jury based on the evidence. Well, I don't think that's the only question. As Mr. Gonzalez has pointed out in his brief, our issue has three sub-issues. And I think that the proof presented at trial perhaps addresses the second sub-issue, but not the first sub-issue, which is what I've chosen to speak about here today, and that's this negative finding in the judgment. I think that the only case that Mr. Gonzalez is relying on or can rely on to support his argument on that issue is this Guthrie Nail case. And I think what I hear Mr. Gonzalez saying is that based on the case law, the state gets all the benefit here. Well, if there's, you know, an inconsistent verdict, well, the state gets the benefit from that. I think what the Guthrie Nail case says is that inconsistency is okay as long as it, the benefit goes to the defendant. The Supreme Court has written that the touchstone of due process is protection of the individual against arbitrary action of government. Well, I think inconsistent and arbitrary are near synonyms. And so it's okay for a verdict or a judgment to have inconsistencies as long as they benefit the defendant. I think Mr. Gonzalez put it really well when he said that Guthrie Nail stands for the proposition that even though the jury may have found someone guilty of an offense, which necessarily includes the use of a deadly weapon, they can enact this sort of semi-clemency and say no on the special issue of whether a deadly weapon was used or exhibited. Again, I think the reverse should not be true. So if we have an offense where a deadly weapon can't be used, the jury can't enact some sort of punishment by inconsistently finding that you didn't use a weapon by committing this offense, but in the special issue, you did use a deadly weapon. I think that that creates a real due process issue for the defendant. Mr. Gonzalez pointed out or argued that Mr. Walker benefited from the state withdrawing the deadly weapon special issue after the jury sent its note out. And I completely agree with that statement. But it happened after the state used the deadly weapon instruction against Mr. Walker, because when the note was sent out, the jury said, we've already decided on what our verdict is on the charged offense. The only thing that we're trying to decide still is whether a deadly weapon was used or exhibited in the commission of the offense. Just to sort of finish up here, I want to make clear that I'm not arguing that assault causing bodily injury can't ever be theoretically susceptible to a deadly weapon finding. I think that there is support in the case law for this. For example, someone can commit a robbery as opposed to an aggravated robbery and use a vehicle as a deadly weapon in flight from committing that robbery. Same thing can happen with an assault. We could have a aggravated assault with a deadly weapon that involves a vehicle. It could end up being an assault with flight using that vehicle, and we could have a deadly weapon finding.
So this part of your brief I found quite interesting, because you suggest that if they used the deadly weapon during the flight, that that would have been okay, and that this charge would have been permissible. But because he didn't flee,
that's
then
correct.
You can't use the charge.
That's correct. And the instructions to the jury in this case eliminate the flight. It is in the state's indictment, but when the court charges the jury, the court only refers to using or exhibiting in commission of the offense. And I think that's appropriate based on the proof that was presented at trial. So again, I think it's theoretically possible for the jury to consider this issue when the offense is assault causing bodily injury, but not in this case because flight's not an issue. And I think that, again, due process requires us to have a criminal justice system that makes logical sense. It has to make logical sense to the benefit of the individuals who are being subjected to potential government action. I think that our position is that submitting this issue didn't make sense in Mr. Walker's case. I don't think it makes sense in any similar cases. And again, we ask the court to find that there was error in the court's charge. We ask the court to reverse the judgment, finding there was egregious harm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Daniel. Mr. Gonzalez, thank you both for a well-done argument, and we appreciate you coming up and doing it during the course of the bench bar here. I understand that can cause you a little bit more stress probably with the crowd. But the case will be submitted. Court will stand in recess. The next case is set for 10:15. Thank you both. You are dismissed.
All please rise.